let us say, even outrageous things would be entirely my own responsibility, and I was careful not to get into too sensitive areas last time. So I'll just recall roughly what was looked at last day. I indicated I was going to look at contexts where there was a model. I wasn't going to get into algorithmic or exploratory data analysis, but look at this central area. There's enough there that needs attention without inviting further complications. Part of the more recent history, there seem to be four streams, and I've indicated those, ones that are distributional, others I've entitled optimality, and then starting to get into a bit of color coding, which will run through the remainder, the things connected with invariance, and then what you could think of as subjective Bayes. So the first two columns would be more or less frequentist, and the next ones you could label more or less Bayesian. I sort of finished off by mentioning what I'll call inference elements, elemental units of inference. So when I write this, I'm thinking of theta as the full parameter. You may want likelihood for component parameters. Likelihood itself as being something primary, and then p-value. When you get into p-value, the p-value is going to be for a scalar parameter, for vector parameters. They're delicate things that need attention, and that's part of ongoing work. The sort of claim is that these are available in wide generality much more than it is usually acknowledged, and what you need to get at them is really just the full likelihood and then a reparameterization, not working with whatever the initial parameter was, but a reparameterization. So part of the recent work is determining what that is, and then after that you can act as if it's an exponential model and get third order results. Part of looking at this was that the heavy emphasis in the first part of the last century on optimality really led to a dead end. Problems weren't getting solved. It was asking people to make decisions when they shouldn't be making decisions. They should be presenting what the evidence is in a context. The thing that kind of broke it were two things in the middle, the 55s. A re-emphasis on a likelihood approach from the distributional side, and then the Savage book, which emphasized, well, use the likelihood, but add a personal prior to that. There were a couple of questions at the end of last day, which probably only partially got dealt with, so I'd be prepared to talk about them today. One was the question, how do you know you're not wrong? I sort of did a double take on that, that my mathematics was being questioned. What my mathematics wrong? But so a few comments before we get into the details on that. Of course, lose twos occasionally in real money situations and other things. I usually collect them out. Usually they occur in the algebra, but I think I found the twos. I think the question had to do with rejecting a hypothesis, and certainly any questions concerning or rejecting a hypothesis I would think was wrong. I was in no way suggesting that you do radical things like that. So maybe I'll come back to those later and I'll see if I can maybe give a context. I'll look at a number of examples. They're fairly simple examples where issues should be apparent. The Weibull gets widely used. It serves as one. There are a couple of other examples involving two measurement instruments and then two sample of two in one case. And then partly the stimulus for this talk was a discussion by Pekka Sinervo in the stat department on the top quark and the data analysis there. And then I'll try to summarize at the end. The reason why I look at the Weibull, if you take the Weibull, which is used a lot in industrial application and work with log units, assume that one particular parameter is known, then it's a location model. So I've indicated that up top, a location model, log of a viable arbitrary location, and then you're faced with a data value. I've recorded the actually density function and the distribution function below, and I've been a little brazen down here and putting it in the form of a density for error and a distribution function for error, even to the point of using an E for the error and E for the exponential E. So that's why I've coded some of the E's there for the error. So looking at it in just the case where we have a scalar y and a scalar theta, and the question, what do the elements say? What are those elementary things, elemental units of inference? And then what do the usual methods say? What was offered with the inference elements was the likelihood and the p-value. In this case, there isn't really any controversy. The likelihood, when you have this model, the likelihood is how much probability gets put at that data point when you translate that. So you get a picture like this. The longer tail on the left becomes a longer tail on the right just because you're looking in the other direction. So that's just a straight plot of the raw likelihood, more or less computer drawn originally and then just traced onto this transparency. The p-value is the integral of that. The integral is available analytically, and this is also a trace of that. No decisions, no suggestions last day of decisions or giving wrong decisions to client, just purely presenting what's there. What are the usual methods say? Well, if you get into those distributional things, sufficiency and the rest of it, they primarily have to do with simplifying down in the first place. We don't have to do this here because we started with a simplified version. So we have the likelihood and the p-value immediately. If you get into optimality, that's where you get the estimates and the tests and recommendations that people accept and reject hypothesis, the kind of thing I was denigrating, I hope, but not loudly enough last time. So what I'll do is look at these in terms of confidence intervals. The thing about confidence intervals is they're all there. In other words, if you look at the p-value function, any confidence interval or any confidence point you want, it's there. What I've done is indicated that by taking the 2.5% point and the 97.5 point, deferring to conventions there by using those two values, reading off the theta hat lower and the theta hat up, two percentile points for the confidence interval. So as far as confidence intervals, there's no particular point you might get into choosing the confidence interval to accomplish something, and I'll have examples that indicate what's happened. No problem just yet. What about that invariance in the Jefferies? Well, this is a nice example because that parameter theta is already in location form. It is a constant information parameterization. So the posterior, just take the likelihood, plug on a constant, and you immediately get a posterior plot. The reference there is just as exploratory analysis. This was recommended in the Annals quite a few years ago, but it gets into the touchy area. If you're a frequentist, you don't get contaminated or you avoid getting into the Bayesian side. Start thinking of the subjective side, though. Investor, suppose he believes the theta can't be large, so he imputes a pi theta to suppress large theta. So that'll take the likelihood function and jam it down. So what the subjectivist does is present this posterior. In normal discourse, he doesn't say what his prior would be and plot it separately from the likelihood and let the users choose. Well, switching to another example, this example's been around a long time. I've even talked about it in this room before. Goes back to David Cox decades ago. You have two instruments in your closet you're going to use to measure something. One instrument is low precision, standard deviation of 100 of some sigma naught, and the other one is high precision, it's the sigma naught. And part of the example is to set things up so you can see what happens when there's this kind of contact. So the procedure is to toss a coin. If it comes up tails, you use instrument one. If it comes up heads, you go to the high precision instrument and measure theta. So your actual variable is a composite thing. It's an indicator for which instrument you're going to use, and then it's whatever the measurement is that you get. Your sample space is two parallel, not parallel, but two real lines, one labeled one and the other labeled two. The statistical model is just a half of one density, whichever density is on that particular line. So that small phi there is just standard shorthand for the standard normal density function. It's a little tidier to use it here, and I'll use it a bit later. What happens as far as the inference elements are concerned? Well, as far as likelihood itself is concerned, there's no problem. You toss the coin, get the instrument, get the measurement. The likelihood function up there corresponds to the instrument that was actually used. When you get into the p-value, it's not quite so simple. The capital phi, and the capital phi there stands for the standard normal distribution function. So there's the standard normal distribution function, the data value substituted in, and the sigma that goes with that particular measurement, the low precision or the high precision. So it'll look like this, but the scaling is going to be radically different depending on which instrument is used. So what you see there is a plot of the p-value based on the instrument that actually made the measurement. And I think whatever general criteria you might have, you can say that that's a sensible thing. You're not going to factor in an instrument that might have been used but wasn't. If you want to proceed more formally, you can appeal to certain notions of conditionality, which were mentioned last time, or just directly refer, I'm going to use whatever corresponds to the particular instrument, or appeal to certain kind of criteria for how you should model things. Well, what about the usual things? Well, the distributional part is kind of innocuous, except it's no help at all. You can't use sufficiency. Sufficiency is going to leave you with the indicator for the instrument plus the measurement. So sufficiency, well, I mentioned last day that sufficiency usually doesn't work and we shouldn't waste our time teaching it. Conditioning, whatever the base is, it does give you the model for the instrument actually used. When you get into optimality, well, it's probably easiest to think of this in terms of confidence intervals. And so if you really believed in the optimality and the rest of it, you might go into the book and say, well, I want a shortest on average confidence interval, or a most accurate or most powerful confidence interval. Criteria that have been examined in great detail by Eric Lehman and many others. Without going into the fine detail, you might come up with something like that. These criteria wouldn't produce exactly like this, but these serve to illustrate the kind of thing that you'd get. If you'd use the first sloppy interval, you'd have 164. I've multiplied that 1.64 of the 90%. I've multiplied that by the standard deviation. You get 164, or 1.64 times the 100 sigma naught. When you're using the high precision interval, you might get something much larger, like 5 standard deviations. Now, this is built into the optimization procedure, and I think it's quite an embarrassment that these methods produce that. Why does that happen? Well, it's a trade-off in the optimization process. If you got an imprecise measurement, you're going to give it a shorter interval. And if it's a precise measurement, you give it longer. On the average, you're going to be much better off. but you're going to misrepresent the particular measuring instrument cases. So this is fairly well documented, and you can say, well, I'm never going to be reaching into a closet and taking a good or a bad instrument. The only thing about it is that stuff is built into just about every statistical model. You just don't see it. So you can be uncomfortable with this, and I think you should be. You should also be uncomfortable in the sense that when you do confidence intervals, in most cases, you're doing coming up with results precisely like that. What about the invariance and the Jeffries approach? Well, everything's kind of reasonable and sensible. What you get for the posterior invariant type prior, a constant, it's just going to essentially produce the likelihood function, and you're going to treat it more or less as a posterior distribution with whatever weight intellectual support you choose to give that. What that does, it doesn't factor in measurements that might have been made if the coin had gone differently, and the other methods do. That's why you get those strange things. When you do those trade-offs in the optimization, you're factoring in the model for measurements that you didn't make. That, as I say, is built into the optimization, and I think I was being a little bit pejorative about those last day, but perhaps not enough. The subjective Bayes. You'd impute your prior, modulate it with L theta, get the blend as your posterior. If you take that at face value, you've lost the likelihood. In other words, those two mixes, what the investigator or the client says and what the data says, have been bonded permanently. Well, here's another example. It's different in a way, but this is where those things are stuck together in the fact that you have two measurements. Sample of two, the distribution is a uniform distribution plus or minus a half. So what you see is a flat distribution, the thing you're measuring plus or minus a half. Why take distribution like this? Because it brings things more into focus. If it's a longer-tailed or shorter-tailed distribution, the same sort of things happen. It's just a little bit less transparent. So there's the statistical model. It's on the plane. Y1 minus theta, Y2 minus theta independence, data, two values. Well, if you stop and ponder it, you could think of putting the two values on your real line and saying, well, they have to come from the distribution. The distribution could be the right or to the left, but it has to catch those two points. So if you take and wiggle a distribution sitting it over top of those two data, there's a certain slack. And the slack is the one minus the difference between those two observations. I call that difference the R, standing for range. It's the range of the sample. So the slack is 1 minus R. That's how much the distribution can shift or move and still catch the data points. Taking that example and thinking of those inference elements that I mentioned, likelihood straightforward, you just plug in. Likelihood is constant. Centered on the sample average, just using the sample average as a relevant quantity to calculate. It's the sample average, and it can go up and down by a half of the slack, of course. The slack is the total amount that's shifting. Half of the slack is the amount on either side of the middle. So the likelihood is constant over that permissible range over the possible values for the parameter. What about the p-value? Well, the location for the likelihood y bar in the permissible range, the p-value, you can calculate it based on that conditioning that I mentioned. You can get that for various reasons, various ways, but the p-value is going to be a straight